You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
Thank you, Brandon, for reading. It's good to see everyone again today. If you have a Bible, keep it open there at James 5, or turn there to James 5, because that's where we'll spend the next few minutes together. Earlier this week, I told my wife that at church today we were going to be dedicating four children, and then we're going to be, of course, celebrating Mother's Day and celebrating moms today. And then I said, you know, it's going to be a little weird after that to stand up and give a sermon on Mother's Day about patience in the midst of suffering. And she said, oh man, that's perfect. And so here we go, moms. This is for you. This just happens to be where we are in the book of James today. It's been a significant Sunday for us as a church so far because we've introduced four precious children to you. We've blessed them. We've prayed for them. We've asked you to make a commitment to them as a church. And as Will mentioned, there's lots more to come of that in the days ahead. There will be 12 more babies born between now and sometime this fall. And so it's a wonderful time in the life of our church as God blesses us with new life, very literally. And as I thought about it, you know, I think pregnancy is actually a fitting image for our text in James 5 today, because we could describe pregnancy as a time of patient expectation. You know, we use that word. We say a couple is expecting. Pregnancy is very much a period of waiting. There's 9 months involved, and that period of waiting sometimes involves difficulty, more so for the woman, right, than for the man. She's the one that undergoes all the challenges and the changes in her body. But men, I mean, it's difficult for men too, right? I've got three kids, and I will say that in the last 2 months of my wife's pregnancies, there were times where I almost froze to death. Right, because she would put the thermostat on 50 every night, and she'd throw all the covers off and say, I'm so hot. And I'd be like curled up in my little corner of the mattress with like trying to grab the down comforter. So suffering for men also. But pregnancy involves this period of waiting, but it's always joyful waiting. It's a real sense of anticipation, right? Everyone is waiting for the arrival of a certain someone. And how often do those parents think about the arrival of that child? Every day, all the time. They've painted one of the rooms of their house in some pastel color, right? They have stockpiled, you know, diapers enough for five children, right? They've, you know, sterilized pacifiers are on standby. They are ready. They are waiting for the arrival of this child, and they're so excited. But for now, they just have to wait. They just have to be patient. And as we've been going through the book of James as a church, the text that we come to today in James chapter 5 is obviously about patience. The word gets used six times here. And James is telling us to patiently await for the arrival of someone, which is really hard for us because we are impatient people. All right, we don't have much training in our culture as it relates to waiting for anything. And so when James says to us today, be patient, it almost seems like an impossible command. It almost seems like James is giving us another law, be patient, that we can't keep, therefore we're just going to feel bad about it, because we're like, ah, I'm so impatient. But as I looked at this passage this week, I actually think James is encouraging us here. I think one thing that James is doing is actually encouraging us to live out of who we've been remade to be in Jesus Christ, according to our new birth in him. It's actually what he's been doing through the entire letter. He's saying that Jesus Christ has changed you and is changing you. You are a new creation in him. Now live out of that. Live out of the change that he's making in your heart. So when I was looking at it this week, it didn't surprise me. I was kind of just racking my brain thinking, you know, what's the key here? And I couldn't quite see it. And then it finally hit me. It finally dawned on me that at the very heart of the passage, James talks about the heart, doesn't he? Look at verse 8, James 5, verse 8. He says, you also be patient. And then he says, establish your hearts. Literally means to fix your hearts, to set your hearts in a certain direction or on a certain something. Fix your hearts. What James wants to say is your heart matters because it's who you are, and who you are will be reflected in what you do. What's in you ends up coming out of you. So I can't just be patient externally, right? I actually need to grow a patient heart. And so how do I do that when I feel so impatient? How do I grow a patient heart? And I think that's where James has taken us in this text today. I want to say this up front. I think a patient heart is in our life is primarily formed not in the big, dramatic, spotlight moments of life. It's actually formed in all the little, tiny, thousands of tiny, little, mundane moments, thoughts, decisions, actions, just in the mundane, everyday things. And I think that's where we're shaped and formed the most, which is actually kind of scary, isn't it? Because those are the moments where it's most difficult to be patient. And so the question is, will I choose the way of Jesus? Will I fix my heart on him? Now, James uses two words for patience here in this text. He uses the actual word patient, and then he uses the word steadfast. And I think these two words are kind of a good guide as to how we should look at the text. Because the word patient deals more with being patient with others, and the word steadfast deals more with, for lack of a better way to say it, being patient with God. Okay? And so let's look at what it might mean in our life to grow a patient heart as it relates to those two areas, patience with people and patience with God. Let's look at patience with people first. Look at back at James 5, verses 7 and 8. James says, "Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and the late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand." So James tells us twice here to be patient. Now, I think sometimes when we think about being more patient, we just think that just means we need to be more calm, right? I want to get more patient. That means I want to be able to go a longer amount of time under difficult circumstances without getting really angry. And that's what we think of patience as. You know, I want to be able to stand in line at the DMV for an hour and a half and not get mad at everybody around me, right? There's an old comedy bit. A guy talks about standing in line at the DMV, and he says, you know, you go at the Department of Motor Vehicles, and you go in there, and it's real quiet, and it's almost like it's serene in there, and everybody's just kind of standing there in line. They're kind of tapping their foot like this. And you think, it's so peaceful in here. And he said, inside, everybody's going, "No! Get me out of here." Is that what it means to be patient, to be able to just be calm? You know, does it mean that I can put the string back on my weed eater without throwing it across the yard? Is that all that patience is, this inner serenity, sort of this Eastern, you know, and I feel more patient? If I could just get more calmness, then my life would go a little better. I think what James is saying here is that patience is about way more than just some sort of inner peace. What James is talking about here has a real relational component to it. James is not talking about just being slow to anger. He's talking about being slow to retaliate, like slow to avenge oneself, right? The context of this passage is that people are getting done wrong by other people. Like if you read verses 1 through 6, some of the rich people are withholding wages from their employees. So there's defrauding going on. Some of the righteous people are being oppressed and accused unjustly and persecuted. So there's injustice going on. In the midst of all this wrongdoing, injustice, defrauding, James says, be patient. Here's the best definition of the word patience that I saw this week. Patience is a self-restraint which does not hastily retaliate against a wrong. Patience is a self-restraint which does not hastily retaliate against a wrong. That means if I'm patient, I have the restraint not to avenge myself. If you smack me, I don't smack you back. Proverbs 20:22, I think it's a beautiful summary of what James is saying. It says this, "Do not say, 'I will repay evil.' Wait for the Lord, and he will deliver you." That's really hard to do, isn't it? what is the signal, or what is a signal in our life that we have an impatient heart toward people? Look at verse 9. Verse 9, James writes, "Do not grumble against one another, brothers." So there's the one another component to this type of patience. "Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door." Grumbling is a sign of an impatient heart, because an impatient heart eventually surfaces in our words. Sinful heart eventually shows itself in sins of the tongue. So when we feel wronged in any way, it's easy to grumble. And this is just verbal retaliation. We gripe, we moan, we nitpick, we speak harshly, we tell everybody whose fault it is, and it's certainly not our fault. And that's what it means to grumble, which is a very normal way of life for us as 21st century Americans, isn't it? Because as 21st century Americans, it is unacceptable. It is unacceptable to put up with any form of injustice, even just the smallest little slight, isn't it? So maybe we get disrespected. Maybe we get overlooked for a promotion or a position. Maybe we get ignored or cold-shouldered out here in a conversation. Maybe someone insults us. Maybe we get misunderstood. Maybe we don't get credit for something that we rightly deserve credit for. Whatever it is, it feels wrong to us. It doesn't feel right. And so we open our mouths to take care of what's wrong. The problem is righteousness doesn't usually come out of our mouths in that moment. I think James is not minimizing injustice here. He is not minimizing wrongdoing here. There are things that may happen to you or have happened to you that are very wrong, like seriously wrong. People may have taken something from you, hurt you in some way. They may owe you something. And if that's the case, your heart cries out for justice, right? And that's a good thing. God has put that desire for justice in you. James is not minimizing that. What James is saying is that grumbling is not the way to deal with that injustice. Because grumbling is just a short fuse. Grumbling is impatience. Grumbling is retaliation. Grumbling is avenging myself. And worse yet, grumbling destroys a community. And I would venture to say that more churches have been destroyed throughout the centuries through grumbling than through any kind of doctrinal heresy. And so James says, be patient with each other. Be patient. How do you grow a patient heart with each other? Look at verse 8. "You also be patient. Establish your hearts. Fix your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand." The coming of the Lord is near. Three times in these first three verses, James mentions the coming of Jesus. In verse 7, he says, be patient until the coming of the Lord. In verse 8, he says, the coming of the Lord is at hand or is near. And in verse 9, he says, the judge is standing at the door. James is saying that if we're going to grow a patient heart, we have to fix our heart. We have to set our heart on the coming of Jesus, and we have to wait for his arrival. And then James gives this example in verse 7 of a farmer. I was thinking about a farmer this week. You know, a lot of what a farmer does involves just waiting. A lot of what a farmer does involves stuff he can't control. He works really hard to prepare the soil. He works really hard to plant the seed. And then in many ways, he just waits. Because he can't make it rain. He can't make the seed grow. He can only do what he is able to do. And he waits on God's timing. He waits on God's calendar. As Sinclair Ferguson says, the farmer waits on the promises and the providences of God. And if you know Sinclair Ferguson, you know he says it way better than I just said it, because he's got this wonderful Scottish brogue. And it's like, the farmer waits, right, on the promises and providences of God. And he says it, and you're like, I want to be a farmer. Waiting on the promises of God. Do you know the next major universal promised event on God's calendar, universal meaning it affects all of us, is the return of Jesus? Literally, the arrival, the coming of Jesus. And James says, wait for that arrival, fix your heart on that arrival. And this was not weird instruction for James readers, because in the New Testament, it was very normal to talk about the return of Christ. It's how they encouraged each other. I was reading this week, there's estimated to be over 300 references to the return of Christ in the New Testament. That means that one, if my math is right here, one in every 27 verses references the return of Christ. That's amazing. I mean, the New Testament wants to tell us a lot of stuff about Jesus. And what that tells me is that the return of Jesus is a huge thing that the New Testament wants us to know. It was the hope of a New Testament church. It was what they're waiting for. It's what they long for. And yet, if we're honest, I think we almost never encourage each other with that truth, do we? Very rarely do I say to someone when they need encouragement, Jesus is coming back. I almost never say that. Usually my encouragement is about fixing and organizing things in the moment, in the now. Ah, it'll be all right, you know, we'll work it out, and, you know, we'll get it together. Jesus is coming back. James wants us to fix our heart on the coming of Jesus, because that's when everything's going to be set right. That's when justice is going to be, that's when injustice is going to be taken care of. That's when everything that Jesus accomplished in his life, death, and resurrection will come to fruition. Sin, Satan, death, vanquished finally at the coming of Jesus. That's when Jesus will come and judge the unrighteous. And we might think, well, yeah, come judge the unrighteous. But then we have to remember we lean on the grace of God, because we are part of the unrighteous, and our righteousness is only in Jesus Christ. And so we look to his coming, but we cling to the grace of Jesus as we do, because his grace will be most fully revealed at his coming. Now, some will say, you know, how could his coming have been near or at hand when James wrote this? Because he wrote this like 2,000 years ago, and I don't think he's come back yet. How could James have written that? I think the word near here does not necessarily mean near in terms of time. It could mean that, right? He could come back right now if he wanted to. But the image that James gives is that Jesus is standing at the door. It's like there's a door right here, and he's just right there on the other side of the door. He's very close. He's very near to returning. I think this ought to cause us to reflect on the patience of God, that he has not returned. Peter says that the reason he hasn't returned is because of the patience of God. Peter says it's not a time thing. 1,000 years, day, it could be anything to God, right? But he's patient so that more might repent. So fixing our heart on his coming produces in us a heart of patience, a long-suffering nature towards other people, because God is long-suffering towards people. And so let me ask you this. How often do you think about his coming? I don't think we do very much, because we're so focused on the immediacy of our lives, aren't we? And this is where we can learn a lot from those who are expecting a child. Those who are expecting, they think about the arrival of that baby every day. They have learned to live the immediacy of their lives in light of their future lives, because they know that what will happen in the future very much affects the now. And so how much more should we ought to think daily about the coming of Jesus? Because our life in the future very much should inform the way we live our lives now. Do not say, I will repay evil. Wait for the Lord, and he will deliver you. Be patient. But there's one other word that James uses for patience, and it's this word steadfast. And rather than having to do with patience with people, I think it has more to do with being patient with God. Okay, let's look at it, what it means to be patient with God. Look at verses 10 and 11 here. James 5, verse 10 and 11. He says, as an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. There's our word. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you've seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. Steadfastness is this, I think it's this disposition that just doesn't give up under suffering, under difficulty. It has the idea of being under something heavy, but not being crushed by the weight of it. You know, I picture like an Olympic, you know, those big old Olympic power lifters that just, you know, they have, they're holding those things above, you know, like 500 pounds above their head. And they're not, they may be shaking like this, but they're not crushed under it. That's what it means to remain steadfast. And the question is, will we remain steadfast? Because the fact of the matter is, life is going to be full of difficulty. If it's not now in your life, it will be. Life is going to involve suffering for all of us in some form. Will we remain steadfast? Will we be patient through those difficulties? And so to illustrate steadfastness, James points to the prophets and to Job. The prophets are like the best examples he can think of steadfastness, endurance under suffering. And those guys underwent so much. Ezekiel, God said to him, go speak my word to these people, to the house of Israel. And then God said, oh, by the way, they're not going to listen to you. You will not be a popular preacher, Ezekiel. They will not be podcasting you, Ezekiel. You're not going to be that kind of minister. Later, God said to Ezekiel, I'm going to take your wife away from you. Your wife is going to die. It says in the book of Ezekiel that his wife was the delight of his eyes, and God took her away. And he told Ezekiel, you cannot mourn out loud, because this is a sign to you, a sign to Israel, that my glory is going to depart from Israel. The thing they should delight in the most is going to depart, and they're not even going to have time to weep or mourn. And that's how Ezekiel was bereaved. Ezekiel suffered. Daniel was deported from his home country. Can you imagine that? Taken out of his home country, raised in a pagan country, persecuted for his righteousness, for just being who he was. Some guys walked in on him having a quiet time. He's just praying, and they fed him to the lions for that. Daniel suffered. Jeremiah suffered. Jeremiah was pursued by his own people because he wouldn't shut up talking about the Lord, and they were tired of it. So they ran him down. They threw him in an empty well, and he's sinking. You know, they're going to leave him to die there. He's sinking in the mud. He's thinking, this is my calling, Lord. I mean, this is what I went to seminary for. He's suffering. It's tough for these guys. C.L. Mitton says that faithfulness to God's commands did not give the prophets immunity from suffering. Faithfulness to God's commands actually involved them in suffering. They were right smack in the middle of God's will, and they suffered. Really, the only reason we know about the prophets at all is because they were steadfast in suffering. It wasn't because that they were successful in ministry, right? These were not megachurch pastors. They were not successful in ministry. They were steadfast in proclaiming the word of God through difficulty, through hardship, and that's why we know about them. They endured patiently, and they clung to God. They clung to his word. And what James is saying, hey, those guys are your example. They're an example of what it looks like to be patient with God when life is difficult. Now, what's the signal? Again, I think there's a signal that we have a heart that is impatient with God. And again, I think it comes in our words, what we say. Look at verse 12, this last verse here. It's a curious little verse here that is even here. It says, but above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth, or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. I think when things get difficult in our life, we can start saying all kinds of crazy stuff, can't we? We start making promises to God, start making promises to others, we start cursing, we start swearing because we're getting squeezed. I came across this observation about the Apostle Peter this week. I thought this was really good. He's talking about Peter when he was right after Jesus got arrested. Peter gets confronted like three times. Hey, you're a Jesus follower, aren't you? And he's like, no. And he denies it three times. Listen to what it says. Under the stress of what Peter saw as personal danger, Peter, in Matthew 26, began to call down curses upon himself and to swear. The tight corner and the loose tongue went together. It was all very far from what Peter intended. He had started out with a very different vow. In Mark 14, he vowed that he would never desert Jesus, that he would die with Jesus. But the stress exposed the weakness, and this weakness found the tongue. And Peter should have never been making vows in the first place. I think what James is saying in verse 12 is this. Hey, be who you are. Do not be double-minded. Be wholeheartedly Christ, no matter what the circumstance. Don't use your words to manipulate God. Don't use your words to manipulate others, right? Don't make false promises to God to make a difficult circumstance less difficult. And don't deny God to make a difficult circumstance less difficult. Yes is yes, no is no. Your words ought to match who you are. That's what he's saying. Now, how do we grow in that? How do we grow in having a heart that's patient with God? I think the answer is the same as before. Fix your heart. Establish your heart. On what? Look at verse 11 one more time. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You've heard of the steadfastness of Job. You've seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. What are we to fix our eyes on? We are to fix our eyes on the purpose. The Greek word there is the word telos, means the end, the ultimate end that God had in mind. We are to fix our hearts on that. What is his purpose? That he would show himself to be compassionate and merciful, tenderhearted, loving toward us. He loves us with all that he is. And James uses this illustration of Job. You know, Job went through the worst of things. Credible pain, credible suffering, credible difficulty. And he wrestled with God. He struggled with God through it. There were times when where he said, I wish I'd never even been born. And yet through it all, he clung to God, didn't he? Job said, I know that my Redeemer lives and he will stand in the end on the earth. And even though my flesh has been destroyed, in the end, I will see God. Job clung to God. He endured. He was steadfast. And he looked to God through his suffering because he knew that God's purpose was to be compassionate and merciful. He fixed his heart on that. I have some friends who 4 years ago, they lost their daughter to leukemia. She was 13 years old when she died. She had undergone what I would say is brutal chemotherapy. She had undergone a bone marrow transplant. And she was so courageous, so joyful, so strong through it all. We watched it unfold over a couple years. And then she went to be with the Lord, which was just devastatingly sad. And I got together with my friend this week, and I asked him about this whole idea of steadfastness in suffering. And I was like, you know, what was that? What was it like for your family? What is it still like for your family? What questions have you asked God? What questions do you still ask God? How did you carry on in the midst of such great pain? And you know what he said? He said, I don't know. He said, I think it's that we didn't have any other alternatives. Like, to whom were we going to turn in this pain but to the Lord? And he told me that through the years, there have been waves of pain and sadness, and there's never been a satisfying question to the answer of why. But he also said it's kind of like working out at a gym. He said, like, we go through tough times, and, you know, it's like a muscle tears. But then when it builds back up, it builds stronger. It tears, builds stronger. And he told me, he said, you know, my relationship with God used to be like this. And he held his hands really close together. And he said, but now through this experience, my relationship with God is like this. And I was like, why? And he said, because I have asked God, I have gone way outside of the bounds of what I had ever asked God before and questioned God and wrestled with God. But I've also experienced way outside of the bounds of what I had ever had before of the intimacy that God promises through that. And he said, all along the way, God has given little tastes of his goodness, little moments of goodness. And I was like what? What's an example? And he told me several stories. I'll just tell you one. He said that he had a buddy that he works with that did not believe in God. And he was telling me this story the other day, and he was just weeping as he told the story. You know, we're at Starbucks, and he's like getting Starbucks napkins, you know, and I'm getting Starbucks napkins. his friend, for some reason, decided that he was going to stop at this church over here on Exposition regularly, almost every day, because he just felt like, I'm not sure I believe in God, but I just feel like I need to pray for my friend's daughter who's suffering. He stopped almost every day, and then he said, one day I was in there, and it was like the presence of God was like pressing down on me. And his friend told him, I had to get down on my knees, and I put my face on the ground. Through that process, over the course of, I guess, the next several months, this guy ended up becoming a Christian. And through the suffering of my friend's daughter, God showed that his purpose was to be compassionate and merciful toward this guy. And my friend said, that's not why I'm saying that my daughter suffered. I don't know why my daughter suffered. But what I do know is that because my daughter was suffering, that guy found himself in a church and he met God there. God is always merciful, compassionate in his purpose. I was so moved, I think, listening to my friend the other day. And I wasn't just moved by his loss and his pain, although I was moved by that. I was moved by the way he loves God. God is so real to him. He told me that he had taken many years before that ever happened to know God, to trust God. And it struck me that that's what it is. Growing in steadfastness is a process over time. And so right now, we need to wholeheartedly belong to Christ so that when the world starts coming apart around us, and it will, that we know that we wholeheartedly belong to him then, right? Only in belonging to Christ can we be patient with God in the midst of suffering. Because only when we belong to Christ do we know that God is with us, that God is walking with us, that God is for us. Jesus is the telos, the ultimate purpose of God. In Jesus, the compassion and mercy of God come to fruition, right? In Jesus, his life, death, and resurrection, we're reminded that God has moved toward the world tenderly, lovingly, patiently. And so when Jesus comes back, one day we will know that love personally in a way that we've never known it before, because it'll be unhindered by injustice, unhindered by suffering. But now we fix our heart on his coming and we wait. And that's how you grow a heart of patience. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.